Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael Merrick, and along with Kevin Amatuzio, we're privileged to represent Travelers Property Casualty Company of America. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before Your Honors. If I could have a 4 minutes reserved for my response, I'd appreciate it.
As long as the clock is working, counsel, you take care of your time. If it goes down, I'll let you know.
Thank you so much. This is an extremely important case, not just for Travelers and StressCom, but for the future of insurance dealings in this state between policyholders, insurers, and underlying plaintiffs. If the judgment based on the verdict is affirmed in this case, it'll stand for five important points. First, you will effectively overrule the 1937 decision of the Colorado Supreme Court in Kessinger. It remains good law, it's binding on the parties, and with all due respect on this court. Stated differently, Kessinger requires reversal. Secondly, the important distinction in the liability insurance context between an outright denial of coverage and a denial of liability to the plaintiff, a very different concept, will be rendered meaningless. Moreover, the distinction between a denial of coverage and a reservation of rights will be meaningless. Third, standard liability insurance policies, which have been issued in this state for nearly 100 years, will be rendered meaningless or at least undercut substantially in several ways. First, the right and duty to defend, which an insurance company has, is granted by the insuring agreement, will be undercut because insurers will not have that right to force the plaintiff to file a suit, force that plaintiff to prove liability and damages, to defend against those claims, and to provide for third-party practice to try to mitigate those losses. The second important provision that will be undercut is the voluntary payments clause. That's at the heart of Kessinger, and it says that pre-suit, you know, without notice to an insurer, an insured may not settle on its own except at its own cost. The third important provision is the duty to cooperate. That's what happens between the time a case is settled and the time notice is provided. And if, in fact, the verdict is affirmed, the duty that StressCom had to Travelers to cooperate, you know, will be rendered undercut, you know, in a very significant way. And finally, the no action clause, which also was at issue in Kessinger, will be undercut because that says that under no circumstances may an insured sue on a policy unless there's been one, a judgment, or two, a settlement entered into with the insurer's consent.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Merrick. I appreciate your concise summary of your position. But let's go directly to your first point,
okay,
that you believe that Kessinger controls this case. Would you please explain your position in light of both Clementi and Friedland?
Okay. Your Honor, Friedland, and that, of course, is what Judge Hoffman applied. They're really very, very different cases. Kessinger is on all fours with this case because it did involve a pre-suit situation. Both Clemente and Friedland involved cases where there was a lawsuit filed. That's a very important point because an insurance company does have a right, okay, to force a case into suit. It has no obligation or no duty to settle a case or to defend, of course. And there is no issue in this case. Everybody agrees the Travelers never had a duty to defend because there was never a lawsuit filed or an arbitration demand submitted. But Kessinger dealt with the situation where the plaintiff made a demand, the carrier denies that demand, so we're not interested. Insured goes out and settles, seeks to recover that from the insurance company, goes to trial, and a directed verdict was entered in favor of the carrier. That was based on the voluntary payments clause and the no action clause. And if you take a look, Judge Bernard, at the case, you will find that the clauses are remarkably similar to what we have here in this case. Now, Friedland was a much different case. Friedland involved an environmental situation. Mr. Friedland was an individual who ran a mining company, well known in this state. He was sued by the US EPA. They came in before that and seized records, okay, seized his insurance policies. He came in and defended the lawsuit for 4 years with sophisticated counsel. He contested liability, and at that point decided it was in his interest to pay $20 million to settle the case. The insurer in that case asserted late notice because the first they ever heard of the settlement was, or the case was post-settlement. They reserved rights and filed a declaratory judgment action on late notice and voluntary payments. The trial court entered summary judgment on late notice, didn't get to voluntary payments, went up on appeal, and all the Supreme Court then dealt with was late notice. It did not deal with voluntary payments. When the case then was remanded to apply the test, the burden shifting test, which I assume you know, there was never another reported decision. The case was resolved. So Kessinger remains good law. Now Clemente was
Mr. Merrick, yes. I hate to interrupt, but I want to try to get to the heart of this issue.
Yeah.
In Freeland, as you point out, the closet issue was a notice clause.
Correct.
Okay. But what I want to know is, what is the principled basis? What is the qualitative difference between a notice provision and the no or the voluntary payment provision? I'm looking at the principles that the court articulated in Freeland, and I'm wondering, why don't those apply with equal force to a no voluntary payments provision?
Your Honor, I have to answer it by focusing on the fact that all this happened in this case without even a lawsuit. Let me suggest to you that there are some states where they've conflated the two, and many states where there are different standards that apply. I cited a Seventh Circuit case the other day, Your Honor, said it was untimely, but, and I apologize for filing it, you know, late, but it only came out on January 8th. It's a big difference here, and I could talk to you about, you know, why there shouldn't be a difference in the case once a suit's filed, okay? But here, let me, and I'll do that in a moment, but focus on the fact that there never was a suit. There was never an opportunity for Travelers to contest liability, okay, to make the plaintiff prove its case. Remember what happened here. StressCon wasn't even on the job the day this all happened. Okay? Subcontractors were doing all the work. And all the while, during 2008, Mr. Nevins of Travelers was working with StressCon cooperatively to try to push the liability down to the subcontractors. That was an agreed-upon strategy. It was an agreed-upon strategy to say to the plaintiffs, or to say to Morton, the prospective plaintiffs, because there wasn't a lawsuit, of course, that we're contesting liability, we're trying to seek, you know, file third-party claims or pursue third-party claims, as it were. And at no time did they ever have an opportunity to come in and do what they were entitled to do under the contract, which was defend.
But that was true in Freeland, too, because they didn't have notice of the case at all until after it was over. So in that respect, Friedland's not different than this case.
But in that case, Mr. Friedland, you know, litigated the case, you know, seriously. He had lawyers who were litigating it. And also, there's a big difference because there, Mr. Friedland didn't know he had available coverage. There was evidence that he didn't know that he qualified as an insured under the insurer's policies. Remember, the EPA took the policies, they took the business records, and there was evidence that he didn't know about that. So the court, in this burden shifting, applied the presumption, and ultimately it was the obligation of Travelers to show that it had been prejudiced. But think about what would happen here, okay, if in fact this verdict were and judgment were to stand. You have satellite litigation in this state where this would be the scenario. Insurance could go out and settle cases, okay, under the threat of double damages, and you know, if you accept the interpretation that StressCon would place on the statute, three times the covered limit. So you have basically $1 million policy would create $3 million worth of exposure. And if you accept what their expert says, that any time you're delaying or you're not actively investigating, it becomes a question of fact as to whether you're denying. And you would allow cases would be settled, and you would have this satellite litigation which would involve this issue, Judge Jones. It would involve relitigating the underlying case with the question being, could the insurer with certainty prove that it would have done a better job in getting a better outcome than did the insurer on its own?
Pardon me, Mr. Merrick. Yes. Wouldn't you make the same sort of arguments if you were here arguing Friedland before us, before Friedland was decided?
Perhaps, Your Honor, because there is good, you know, established case law nationally, and that treats notice as a strict condition precedent to coverage.
But if that's so, doesn't that dovetail with Judge Jones's question that those same problems might exist now under Friedland anyway, and that you're not suggesting something new to us about if we were to feel that Friedland and Clementi have driven the decision here?
No, Your Honor, I keep coming back to the fact that there were lawsuits that were being contested in those situations, and that at least gives some balance to what's going on here. Remember that if you go back and look at what StressCon did with Mortenson, at the end of the day, it paid about $3.2 million. And at the very end of 2008, when Travelers thought they were working in concert with one another, but instead, when pressured by its business partner, it did this deal. After you unravel everything, the phase one jury verdict, the phase two jury verdict, about $547,000 was found to be covered damage, accident-related damage.
4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah.
That's about 16% of what of the total. So when Travelers was supposedly to step forward and do something pre-suit, which it doesn't have to under its contract, okay, there was no allocation of damages, okay? And at the end of the day, it was really the dog being the business dispute between Mortenson and StressCon, and the tail was really the potentially covered damages. So the problem in what will happen here if this is sustained, there will be incredible, you know, manipulation of lawsuits, of relationships between insurers and insurers, because there really won't, anything could morph into any a denial of coverage. For example, look at the letters. Look at the April 2008 letter that Mr. Gunnels, in his opening and his closing, made such an argument of that this was a denial of coverage. It was not. It was a reservation of rights letter. I'm running out of time, but I could go through line by line and show you it's just that. No witness has ever pointed to a piece of paper that said Travelers denied. They did not. In concert with StressCon, they said to the plaintiff, hey, you know, we're not sure there's liability, prove your case. They did that later in 2008, in September, but there was never a denial of coverage. Absent a denial of coverage, StressCon had no ability to ignore the contract, settle on its own, except at its own expense. If the rule in the state is otherwise, things will be up for grabs, particularly with the bad faith statutory overlay to this. Because as I said before, you couple that with the Basher situation and none, you can only imagine the type of creative deals that the trial courts will be dealing with and Your Honors will be dealing with after that.
Mr. Merrick, you're aware of the Lorick decision by a division of this court.
Yes,
That related to a consent to settlement clause, which is very similar, perhaps not identical, mm-hmm. to the no voluntary payments clause here. But that division held that the principle of Friedland, the burden-shifting approach, applied to a breach of a consent to settlement clause. What distinguishes a consent to settlement clause from the no voluntary payment clause at issue here?
It's different because Lorick involved a underinsured motorist situation, which was a first-party benefit owed to the insured directly. So, for example, there was an individual injured in an auto accident. Okay. Say, I don't have the exact limits,
yeah.
but let's say it was a
25,000.
Yeah, 25,000 limit right. that the tortfeasor had. Let's say he had a $100,000 limit on his own policy. Mm-hmm. Okay. The box and the reason it's much different is because the insured wants to collect, you know, if the injury is sufficiently, you know, extensive, he wants to collect on that $100,000 policy, but has a problem with entering into a release with the tortfeasor, the tortfeasor's insurer, because it would destroy potentially his own insurer's subrogation rights over. So the court, in I think what's underlying all this is the compensation of the insured that has a first party, a one-on-one relationship with the insurer. This is a liability insurance contract. Let's not forget this. And as you look, I think it was blurred very substantially by the jury instructions. And there are all kinds of problems I'd love to point out with the jury instructions. But to highlight those, One is that it did not speak in terms of what the statute says, which is that monies need to be owed to be actionable under the statute. There has to be a contract basis to give rise to an obligation under the bad faith statute. That was notably missing from any of the instructions. There was also notably missing any reference to the Mortensen claim. It was all the StressCon claim. The problem with that is that StressCon really had no claim at that time. There was a dialogue going on between Travelers and StressCon, but they had no claim because they weren't sued, they weren't seeking defense costs, and there was no judgment or settlement which would be covered under the policy.
Thank you, Mr. Merrick. Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Brett Gunnell arguing on behalf of StressCon Corporation. Your Honors, this really is a quite simple case to decide on appeal. It's an easy case about an insurance company, Travelers, who denied coverage and abandoned its insured StressCon. And left to its own devices, StressCon was entitled under those circumstances, under well-developed law, to protect itself from crippling exposure to a Mortensen claim by negotiating a settlement, which was never argued to be anything other than pre-suit. Travelers subsequently refused to pay that settlement when its duty to indemnify for what clearly became a legal obligation of StressCon to Mortensen for cover damages. StressCon refused to pay that, which was a denial that triggered the bad faith statute.
Mr. Goodell, I want to focus right in on that. Because there's a lot of talk in the briefs about actions that occurred before the settlement and before Travelers was notified of the settlement. And yet you've just said, as I think you said in your brief, that it was only upon the settlement and the notification of that settlement that Travelers had any contractual obligation at issue in this case at all. And that was the obligation to indemnify, because there was no duty to defend triggered here. So why does anything before Travelers learning of the settlement matter?
Because, Your Honor, there is Travelers, and it was a matter of fact decided by the jury, prior to the time of the settlement, a question posed to the jury, had denied StressCon's claim for benefits. Now, Mr. Merrick suggests we don't know what that is. That's benefits under the policy.
But it didn't have a claim for benefits at the time. You just said the claim for benefits, and that's the statutory language, the claim for benefits, that didn't arise until they had notice of the settlement. That was a legal obligation to pay.
The duty to pay
correctly
arose under the settlement. But an insurance company can deny coverage before they have a duty to pay. They can anticipatorily deny coverage. They can take a position, as they did here, that their policy doesn't cover tort liability, or only covers tort liability. And so that colors their actions. And in fact, we know that the evidence the jury heard was that from Travelers Adjuster himself, is that there was no circumstance, no fact he could dream of, nothing he could articulate that would ever change his position that he would participate in a subsequent settlement. StressCon interpreted that as a denial of coverage. That question went to the jury. There was no objection to that jury question. That question has not been the subject of appeal, and the jury was asked whether the claim for benefits of StressCon was denied before the settlement. We answered in the affirmative.
Well, what is StressCon's position on the precise date upon which a benefit was denied, a benefit that was payable was denied?
Okay. Well, if you're talking about the language of the statute,
which is the only language at issue in this case,
and the statute says unreasonable delay or denial of a covered benefit. Claim for payment of a covered benefit. That duty arose when the legal obligation under the settlement was created. That's the end of December 2008.
Well, but they didn't know about it at the end of December 2008. They were notified by StressCon sometime later. How could their obligation to pay arise before they're even informed there's been a settlement?
Well, and it doesn't matter because they haven't paid this date. We can pay
any date. No, they haven't paid. Granted, they haven't paid. So that's definitely relevant. What I'm trying to determine, though, is under the statute. I don't want to conflate some common law bad faith claim or a duty to defend claim with a claim under this statute, which is the only claim we have at issue here. So I want to focus, I want to try to determine what is the date upon which the benefit was payable under the statute. And I think you're saying either the date of the settlement or when they learned of the settlement.
Well, let me correct what I said. The duty to pay was triggered upon the, there wasn't a legal obligation which could trigger duty to pay until the settlement was entered into.
So there could have been a delay. There could not have been a delay of that until it happened, right?
Well, the delay came after that duty.
The delay came after, correct.
And the denial came after.
So I go back to my original question. Since the delay came after, what do we care what happened before?
Well, honestly, the reality is that previous denial of coverage, what it means in the case is whether or not the voluntary payment provision can operate as a condition on coverage. So in a sense, you're right. Because without that previous denial of coverage, what we have is then a situation where that settlement was clearly done without consent. And now the question is, under the burden-shifting standard in Freeland, now that we do have a duty to pay and we have a delay and a denial, has StressCon met the burden-shifting standard? And that standard outlined in Freeland says you start with a presumption of prejudice, which StressCon has to deal with. That was correctly done by the trial court. The trial court, at the conclusion of StressCon's evidence, made a legal ruling that the presumption had been rebutted. That is not on appeal. The effect of that is the presumption loses its probative force, and then the law under Freeland is the jury is instructed that the burden now is on travelers to show actual prejudice. That question directly was put to the jury. Was travelers prejudiced by the settlement without consent? And based on all the evidence, the jury concluded no prejudice. And so,
pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Gunnell. I'm sorry. But I want to return to Judge Jones's question, if I may. Would conduct that occurs before travelers learns of the settlement and denies benefits, is that conduct evidentiarily relevant to the issues under 1116?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I'm saying Judge Jones says, what does it matter what happened before they learned of it? I'm wondering is any of the traveler's conduct before that time evidentiarily relevant to the statutory claim?
The delay or denial of a covered benefit?
Yes.
No, I think that the delay or denial of the covered benefit is triggered by the settlement agreement and the time period after the settlement agreement.
So,
but the conduct is relevant to whether or not Travelers met its obligations under the policy and abandoned its insured
Why is it relevant under this statute? Sure, it's relevant under the common law of bad faith, but that's not what we're hearing.
Oh, right? Okay. Well, it's relevant. You're right. It's relevant. For the purpose that Travelers loses the protections of the conditions of the policy if Travelers materially breaches the policy first. That's the Coors case. And so in this case, that question was, what was litigated? There was never a question about, were we litigating about the Mortensen claim? Everyone knew they denied the claim to Mortensen. That letter was in evidence. It was in the case from the beginning. The fundamental question the jury had to grapple with was, had they denied StressCon its rights under the policy, benefits under the policy?
Well, but let's focus on this pre-settlement period. What obligation did Travelers have during that pre-settlement period to do anything under the policy?
Well, Travelers, an insurance company can't, if an insurance company says to an insurer, it doesn't matter what happens, we're not going to be there, as a hypothetical. We will not cover your claim. We think you misrepresented something in the application for the policy. We will not cover your claim. At that point, you know, we have a competing interest in dealing with insurance policies. And although Travelers have rights, we haven't talked a lot about StressCon's rights. And when they're told by an insurance company, you know, we won't be there to protect you, the fundamental purpose of the policy, which is protection, has been lost.
That's a breach of the duty to defend, right?
No, that could be, it could be a breach of the duty to defend.
But here,
it could be just a pure abandonment of their role as the insurer.
But that's a different claim, I think, is Judge Richmond's point. We're dealing with a statutory claim with particular language in it, dealing with the delay or denial of a benefit payable.
Well, let's focus on the statutory claim, because I will concede that the factual question the jury answered, that Travelers pre-settlement had denied StressCon's claim for benefits, and that was the language of the jury instruction, that is relevant because that means that the conditions of the policy offer no protection for Travelers. But set that aside, and then just go to the settlement, which clearly created a duty to pay. After some period of time, you can define it, the expert said 60 days, there becomes a legal obligation of Travelers to pay under the policy. They didn't then, they didn't the next year, they didn't when the suit was filed, they haven't to date. There's clearly a delay and a denial of the payment of those benefits. No one's arguing that the settlement created a legal obligation to pay. The argument is that settlement was without consent. But that question went to the jury. That question went to the jury. Does that matter? And ultimately, to address your earlier point, the principles underlying Friedland are that we recognize insurance companies have the right to be protected with notice provisions, consent to settle provisions, and other protections in the policy. But we also recognize that there are insured rights as well. And so we balance those interests. They looked at a couple of factors and ultimately concluded that the prejudice test is the proper way to work through those issues and effectively balance those interests. They got a chance to make all the arguments you just heard Mr. Merritt make about how terrible it is that they didn't know about the settlement, how things could go wrong if you allow insurance companies to do this, or insurers to do this. The bottom line is, that was a question of fact for the jury, correctly under Friedland. And the jury looked at that question and said, no prejudice. So the only real question for this court is, does Friedland apply?
Well, I guess I'm not focusing so much upon this Friedland burden shifting framework, but simply upon the question of, is there evidentiary support for the claim that there was an unreasonable delay or denial of benefits? And you have to prove that, regardless of Friedland applying, that's what the statute requires you to prove. Okay? Well, and so I'm trying to focus on, well, what evidence is relevant to that determination of whether there's an unreasonable delay or denial of the payment of these benefits? Okay, and that's why all my questions have been relating to, you know, is it relevant to what happened before or only what happens later? So after the settlement, what we have, it appears to me, is simply a refusal to pay. So certainly we have a denial at that point. Okay, we have it. But as I understand it, that denial is based upon Travelers' interpretation of the policy, the no voluntary payments provision and the no action clause. And no court in this state has ever opined on that. How can that be unreasonable for them to take that position that that's what the contract says and we intend to abide by it?
Actually, Travelers' position was fundamentally based on the fact that they only covered tort liability and would never provide coverage for this claim because it arose out of a contract with Morrison. And that was a matter that colored the judgment all the way through the trial. It's extensively throughout the evidence. And the plain fact, as you mentioned, Your Honor, is that ultimately there has been and continues to be a delay and denial of payments of benefits that arose from the settlement agreement.
But was it unreasonable? Did the jury find it?
The jury found it was unreasonable.
Did they find it was unreasonable to not pay because Travelers' position on the settlement without consent or the voluntary payments thing was not a reasonable position? Was the jury asked a question that found that let them find that? Because if they did, then you have a base for saying there was an unreasonable delay. But I'm not sure the jury was asked that question.
Well, the jury wasn't asked that question. That would have been Travelers' burden to put that question to the jury to make sure, and a motion in limine or some other instruction to make sure that they could define what the jury did. But there's no objection to the jury instruction. The jury was asked the question, did Travelers unreasonably delay or deny a benefit? Now, someone might say, should have been a better question put to the jury, but there's no way to review that because there's clearly evidence in the record from which a jury could conclude under a plain error or clear error standard that the delay or denial was unreasonable. The jury could consider all the arguments that you're suggesting about, well, I mean, they had a valid defense. I mean, we heard fairly debatable 100 times during the trial about the position of travelers, that they had a fairly debatable position. The jury heard all that, ultimately concluded there would be no difference. And probably, based on the fact that Mr. Nevins testified unequivocally, he would never participate in the settlement of the Morrison claim.
Can I ask you a question? Did the common law breach of duty claim go to the jury as well?
All three claims went to the jury.
Did they render a verdict?
Yes, we prevail on all three claims.
On all three claims.
All three.
So what you have is
a breach of contract claim, breach of the policy.
Same damages for all three claims?
Well, there weren't any different damages because we didn't prove punitives under the common law, so it didn't create any additional liability, but it was an additional factual finding by the jury.
With all due respect, the blending of those different theories is partly what causes, I think, our confusion on this. And I don't fault you because until our recent case came out, we didn't make it clear that statutory bad faith and common law bad faith are two different duties. Our cases now make that clear.
They clearly are different, and I think that the jury actually, if you read the questions and the instructions, going right to the verdict form, I think you find that they were correctly instructed on all the elements of those claims. Now, someone can argue you could write a different instruction or another instruction, but the instructions were clear. And these are factual questions, and really, all these concerns about what could happen, that's not this case. Okay, that's better left for another day if those facts come up before this court. And I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. We very much appreciate your arguments today. Please drive safely home. This case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.